So thank you so much for listening to the Commonwealth Roundtable podcast. So this is where we talk about global issues that are impacting global communities. It's my pleasure to invite Dr. Isha Govia to speak with us on a topic that's very close to my heart because my grandfather, he actually passed away with dementia, and ever since I've kind of been involved in this space. And Dr. Govia has done a tremendous and significant amount of research and also supporting the community in this area. So it is really, really a pleasure to have her on the podcast, sharing about her research, but also having a candid and honest conversation on the experiences of African and Caribbean communities in relation to dementia. So please introduce yourself and we will get started with the conversation.
Thanks, Rihanna. It's a pleasure to be here on the podcast and to be speaking with the listeners. I'm Dr. Ishta Govaya, and I'm trained as a psychologist and have worked as an academic researcher for a couple decades. And in that role and in that capacity, have led a number of research studies that are very community-based and which focus on what do community members experience and feel when they are living with non-communicable diseases? How do they navigate the health and care systems that are meant to be supportive, but sometimes from which they're quite disconnected? And what are the additional types of resources that we need to be implementing in these contexts? And it's in that space as well that I've done a lot of work in dementia risk reduction and dementia prevention, in community awareness, in education, in training, and in figuring out what research we still need in order to understand the magnitude of the issues that confront our communities and where interventions would be most appropriate. So I'm really thrilled to be here today speaking about these issues.
Thank you so much. And then I think for our audience, it would be useful to give a definition of dementia. So I've just pulled one up from the World Health Organization, and it says that dementia is an umbrella term for several diseases affecting memory, other cognitive abilities, and behavior that interferes significantly, sorry, with a person's ability to maintain their activities of daily living. So I just wanted to give that background so people have an awareness of what dementia is. So, if we're using an audiovisual context, we would say, okay, picture dementia as an umbrella, and you have your friends, your comrades under the umbrella. So, there's Alzheimer's, Huntington's, frontotemporal dementia. So, this is what classifies dementia. Dementia in itself is not a specific disorder. It's a range of types of
The
dementia
syndrome,
that fall
correct.
under, exactly, that fall under that banner. And today, we really want to get into the experiences of African and Caribbean communities in the UK. I know most of your work kind of focuses in the Caribbean, but you also done some work in the UK as well. So if you could just share, how does that compare to those in the Caribbean, especially when it comes to healthcare and support systems?
The UK health system is very different from many of our Caribbean healthcare contexts. And in some ways, there are remarkable similarities. So we can focus first on some of the key differences. In the United Kingdom, for example, there are formal care pathways. Over the past decade and a half, especially, there's been an infusion of policy-related efforts and funding that has focused explicitly on building these care pathways. And a care pathway goes from detecting any signs of cognitive impairment to actual diagnosis of any condition that's resulting in a dementia. And then focuses on what does that person who is experiencing the dementia need in terms of their care management and in terms of resource linkages. And also A crucial part of that care pathway is thinking about living well and dying well. So, in the UK context, that dementia care pathway is very explicit, it's articulated, and from each level of the UK health and care social health and care system, there's an expectation that there are services that are built into the very fabric of the integrated care system, the integrated care board, the trusts, the councils, the actual GP surgeries. In the Caribbean, there are often no dementia care pathways that are explicit. And that's because Caribbean countries typically are not prioritizing dementia at the policy level. And so the health and care programs aren't explicit in their naming of dementia and in their building out of services in those categories that we've just articulated. And so what you find is that persons, and this is where there are similarities, because even though the care pathway exists in the United Kingdom, it is not as easily accessed or utilized by persons from Caribbean, African, and other ethnic backgrounds because of many different issues which we can get into. In the Caribbean, the pathways aren't explicit, they don't necessarily exist, and even the providers tend to be very confused about what to do in these types of contexts. And so, what we find is that persons present extremely late. They present at the point of crisis, and they present when there is quite likely not very much that can be done in terms of cognitive rehabilitation and/or management. And so, those are some of the key differences in the context.
Amazing. Thank you so much for that. And I'm glad that you touched upon the system not really understanding how to cater for African and Caribbean communities, because of a range of factors, as well as the dying well aspect. And for us, I think mainly in the Caribbean, we live in a culture where, a lot of us are Christians, a lot of us practice our faith. So when we say dying well in the Caribbean, sometimes it kind of is not really understood because we're like, what do you mean dying well? When I die, I will meet God, So there's something else to look, towards. But then sometimes people may see dying well as, this is all I have. This is the life I have. And if I want, there's nothing else after this. So there's definitely a cultural disparity when it comes to even things like the dying well and what that looks like and what how it's perceived by different countries. So that's quite interesting, I would say.
Yes, it's a really important point that you've just raised, Rihanna, because dying well, the phrase, might seem to be very universal in its interpretation, but there are actually various interpretations of that. So, one interpretation could be religion-based, where dying well means, as you've articulated, meeting the maker again and ensuring that you go to meet your maker in a state of contrition, in a state of peace, and in a state where you believe that you've settled all of your debts. Dying well, in other contexts and other interpretations, means dying without being in excruciating physical pain. It means dying with the people that you love around you. It means dying in a safe context, a home context, versus in an institutional type of context. It means not having the rush to the hospital when your dying process is inevitable, and instead being in a state where you can remain at home and experience that process without the intrusiveness of some of the hospital types of paraphernalia and additional stressors. So it means different things to different persons, and the phrase itself can be interpreted differently. Thanks for pointing that out.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for expanding on that. And I just wanted to touch on the cultural aspect about it as well, because as you know, and I know, Black people and people from Caribbean backgrounds are more at risk for attaining dementia. So that aspect we need to really highlight and appreciate that our community really needs the information to navigate dementia to reduce our risk, so I think that's quite important. And I would like to know about the appropriate information that people would need, after dementia diagnosis in our community. And do you know if there's, what impact does it have on individuals and their families, including children and grandchildren, which are often left out? But everyone is experiencing this journey together when someone gets dementia in the family. So it's not just the spouse, it doesn't just stop with the children, but also the grandchildren also experience this journey in their own way. So it would be good to find your insights on that.
So, after a dementia diagnosis, which assumes that the person actually gets a dementia diagnosis, because one of the big issues that we face with African Caribbean communities in the United Kingdom is that often we do not get a diagnosis because we are not entering into the healthcare system, because we do not trust the healthcare system, we do not trust the larger political, social type of environment. So, if somebody does enter into the health and/or care system and gets a diagnosis, some of the supports that are really crucial depend on the stage at which that diagnosis is given. So, if it's very early in that journey with dementia that a person is experiencing, the types of supports include cognitive rehabilitation, includes physical activity, things to keep the person as cognitively and physically stimulated as possible. It includes doing a thorough review of this person's medication regime and figuring out where the medications can be better and more effectively managed. It includes very practical things, like ensuring that they have a lasting power of attorney and ensuring that there is a care partner who is explicitly identified and named for medical and other related interventions and programming. And those are some of the key areas where somebody who has been diagnosed relatively early in that process can receive a lot of support. Admittedly, sometimes the services are not as clearly signposted as possible. And sometimes that's quite unfortunate because there are lots of services that are to be utilized, but there's also an information gap in terms of the people that actually rely on, need that information. And this is where organizations like the Alzheimer's Society here in the United Kingdom are really important. So it's crucial to identify your local Alzheimer's Society branch and really try to connect with them at that point in time. If the diagnosis comes later on in the process, then it's important for not just the individual who's living with the diagnosis to start to not start, but to put things in place. But this is where that support network becomes even more crucial. So after diagnosis, this is when you see, and as a diagnosis, as a the disease progresses, this is where you expect to see the individual quite likely losing levels of independence and becoming more dependent And so it's really important for that care network to start to step up that type of support, whether it's practical, whether it is financial, whether it's emotional, whether it's about companionship, whether it's about actual what we call activities of daily living, showering, meals, all of these types of things. And then this links to the second part of your question in terms of how does this diagnosis, how does this condition as it evolves, how does it affect not just the individual who's living with the condition, but the people who are around, their children, their siblings, their grandchildren, for example. And the very, very tough answer to that is that it's really hard, particularly at the beginning of a journey, if that person either does not have insight to realize what is happening. And so when the family members are, if the family members even recognize that this is not normal aging, this is actually an indication of a disease process at work here. If the family members are able to have that recognition and realization and attempt to have a conversation, attempt to intervene with all of the types of challenges that we know can sometimes be inherent in African and African Caribbean family dynamics, which are about position, authority, age, all of these types of things that might make it extremely sensitive issues to be confronting. If they've gone through all of that and are actually able to have that conversation, and this person does not have insight, it makes it really very challenging to sometimes do the types of interventions that can support that person actually, because the person who's living with the condition might not be able to recognize and appreciate that these are actually ways in which my family is trying to help me. They're not trying to hurt me. And it's that space where the individual who is living with dementia is experiencing so much disorientation, so much confusion, and so much fear. If you can only imagine that the life that you have known is no longer the life that you are experiencing, and you have started almost to recognize the ways in which your skills and your abilities are fading or changing. You can only imagine how absolutely terrifying that must be, that could be to somebody. And so, if families are really doing their best to help the individual in this space, the truth is that they too are probably in a grieving process. They too are probably feeling quite overwhelmed. And they too, especially as the person's level of dependency increases, they're stretched in so many different directions. So they're feeling demands from the person whose functioning is deteriorating, and they're also feeling demands from the other spheres of their lives, the other relationships, work and work demands, etc. And so this does have many ripple effects in terms of the health and well-being and functioning of even the carers. And once one generation is affected, other generations are affected. And particularly younger generations are very affected if the language and the ways of managing this that families may be exhibiting aren't necessarily the most compassionate, aren't necessarily the most educated, aren't necessarily the ones that are about figuring out how do I increase this person's quality of life.
Yeah, no, definitely. Thank you for sharing. I think one thing that we can also see when it comes to children and grandchildren is that family dynamic, right? So, it's like the older adults are like, this is our problem, this is an adult problem, we'll deal with it, and so on. And then they exclude the children and the grandchildren because although they're not, in a sense, ready for that responsibility, there are still things that they can do, like talk to the person who has dementia, bring photos, share those memories, play music for them, bring a cup of water to the person. So I mean, they can help in their own way. So I think we definitely have to, not exclude them, but include them in this journey because yeah, we all would have to do our part when someone in our family has dementia. So yeah, I think it's good to include them in the conversation and include them as much as they can as to what is happening, because it's not nice to be in a state where you don't know what stage the person is in or if there's a possibility of that person surviving and so on. So yeah, I think it's useful to have these conversations with everyone in the family, no matter what the age of the person is, it's really based on relationship. Everyone would have a relationship with that said individual, wouldn't they? So yeah, no, thank you for that. And then you also spoke about a resource like Alzheimer's Society and so on. And I was wondering, have you seen much of an intergenerational approach to dementia resources by any chance? So stuff that include young carers, so people who are younger, who are taking care of their family member with dementia.
There are a number of very promising interventions in this space, and they involve, for example, care facilities that are explicitly for older persons, but which have young children coming to do visits, or they build in nursery centers in facilities that also have care facilities for older and aging persons. That type of intergenerational contact can be extremely cognitively stimulating because one of the key aspects that contributes to somebody's positive and healthy brain functioning is social relations. And so we see a number of interventions in that space in terms of trying to facilitate these intergenerational relations and dynamics. In terms of the communities that we are particularly focused on here, there are similar types of initiatives. Where I think there is a lot of promise is on initiatives that are focused on educating and public awareness with younger persons. So not just about younger persons as carers, but thinking about the potential for dementia prevention, dementia risk reduction, by educating young people about their brain health and about their agency in their brain health. And their agency in their brain health focus on aspects that we know are connected to these modifiable risk factors for dementia prevention. So from being very present in your schooling days, in terms of your education, that's a crucial intervention that can have paid dividends later on down the line in terms of your cognitive functioning. And then understanding how different health conditions that may not seem to be connected to your brain health at all are actually very connected to your brain health. So when children are educated, for example, about things like diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, the importance of taking care of their eye health, their vision, their hearing, all of these aspects, their levels of depression and anxiety, their loneliness, because being socially connected. When children are educated about these types of factors and understand their role in holistic brain health, it can also pay dividends later down the line. So, yes, there is potential. There are interventions that do focus on intergenerational dynamics, intergenerational dialogue, intergenerational interactions, creating spaces for this type of intergenerational connection. There are also initiatives that focus on younger generations, not just as carers, but as persons who are holders of their own future brain health. And so ensuring that they understand their agency in this without necessarily using these types of words or phrases, but the different ways that their daily activities and practices have implications for down the line, and why it's important to take care of these things now. Because that's a very clever intergenerational approach. Because once a child is learning about these things, the child is quite likely speaking to his or her parents about it, speaking to his or her grandparents about it. And so that's ways to facilitate this intergenerational relations and dynamics, dialogues around these issues as well.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing. I also wanted to ask, what are some of the biggest challenges faced by people living with dementia and their carers, particularly within African and Caribbean communities? If you could share, that would be
Sure.
appreciated.
Sure. So the challenges are very myriad. And one of the main challenges focus on, as I've talked about before, missed diagnoses and inappropriate or inaccurate diagnoses. So that has two sides to that. So that's the side of the people from our communities not necessarily wanting to connect or enter into the care system, but there are also reasons why persons from our communities don't want to enter into the care system. So that speaks to the other side of things, because sometimes the practitioners are don't either have the appropriate tools to understand and to facilitate detection and diagnosis in a way that is culturally appropriate, because they're using tools that were developed and normed not for our populations, but for other populations, which tend to be not in the US context, non-Hispanic white, in the UK context, white, etc. And these tools may not pick up on some of the cultural nuances that are relevant for our populations. So, missed diagnosis and inaccurate diagnosis, that's one of the main challenges. These cultural biases, the lack of culturally sensitive tools, all connect with that as well. Another key challenge for us is that persons from African, African Caribbean, Southeast Asian, Romani, and all of these populations are not entering into clinical trials as much as the persons who are from higher socioeconomic status brackets or from very specific ethnic groups. And that's a challenge, because that means that the medications, the therapeutics, the interventions that are being developed are not being developed in with samples that are representative of the real populations. And so there's a mismatch often in terms of the pharmacological or behavioral interventions that are proposed for our population. So that's another challenge that we face. Then a challenge that we've been talking about throughout this podcast so far implicitly is systemic healthcare discrimination. And that's a real challenge that we must name. We must appreciate that the systems are not necessarily set up to facilitate equity and facilitate equitable care and access, and that sometimes that inequitable access manifests in things like geographic barriers, particularly in terms of access to specialist care. And then another challenge that we've been talking about in this conversation so far are things that are related to cultural stigma in terms of understanding how can we create more spaces to have early conversations, open conversations that can lead to earlier interventions. And that can lead to informed interventions, because we were just talking about the possibility of parents or grandparents or relatives having conversations, but they can't have conversations if they don't understand things themselves, if they don't have the vocabulary, if they don't have a sense of how does this present, if they don't understand what is cognitive functioning, how is cognitive functioning different from your physical functioning. What is it that we need to be paying attention to? And there, So there are opportunities in the context of all of these challenges to create some very culturally specific solutions.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. And we spoke about the challenges. So, despite the challenges, what aspects of caring for someone with dementia can be fulfilling or rewarding? Like, can you share some insights from your work with carers, through your company? It would be good to find out a little bit more about this area.
Thanks, Rihanna. So, in our work with family carers and other informal carers and community members, in our work through Imagi Health Limited, which is my company that you just referenced, what we've heard from them and learned from them is the significant role that caring plays in terms of. Particularly when that caring is done in a sensitive way and it can start from early on, the role that caring plays in preserving family legacies, preserving family traditions. And we know how important legacies and traditions are for communities like ours. And also the significant opportunities for connection in terms of emotional connection with this person. Cultural connection with this person because they might be recalling, remembering things from their cultural background and upbringing, particularly for the ones that are here in the UK, that were from their years outside of the UK, their years growing up in their country of birth or their parents' country of birth. And so the opportunities that caring provides for these reconnections, these rememberings are enormous. They're immense. And we hear that a lot. And carers often find a lot of satisfaction, emotional satisfaction, personal satisfaction, because in our communities, family is so important and having a sense of fulfilling your family duties, your fam doing right by your family is super important to us. And then the way in which that caring can connect you with the wider community is also another opportunity for carers that they've spoken of in terms of how their network can actually be strengthened. Now, I hasten to add, though, that there is a flip side to that, because if there is no dialogue about these issues, if the communities and the spaces into which they're going are still very, very biased, they have a lot of implicit prejudices towards persons who are showing any types of dependencies or impairments, and oftentimes persons lump things related to dementias, conditions related to dementias, because of the way the functions that it affects, they lump that into mental illness. And that's not necessarily accurate. So that collapsing of dementia with mental illness then introduces its own types of stigma. And so there's a resistance and a reluctance to talk about these things. But if we can open more spaces, what we have found is that once we have created common spaces, safe spaces for these types of conversations to happen, it can actually be such a relief to persons who are playing these carer roles because they find a deep sense that I'm not alone. I've been feeling incredibly alone. I've been feeling incredibly burdened. I've been exhausted, but I know. I can see, I can hear that there are others who look like me, who sound like me, and who are also on this journey too.
Absolutely. And I appreciate that you mentioned, the joy in caring, because in a lot of our communities, we see care as a duty. I must take care of my gran because she took care of me. I need to take care of my mom because she took care of me. And there's, I guess, a global debate as to whether, the fa it's the family's duty to do that or if it's the government's duty to do that. So there's a whole heap of discussion around that. But in our community, we see it, I would say, as a duty, to give back to those who have taken care of us. So that
Can I
is
just
also.
jump in there, Rihanna, to say that often what you've articulated is how things are presented. So it's either the government's responsibility or the family's responsibility. But it's actually not either or, because a family should not be expected to hold the entirety of the financial, the emotional, the logistic responsibilities that caring for somebody who's living with a progressive illness means, the nuts and bolts of that. Because regardless of how much support the government might be offering in terms of programming and interventions, it's not sufficient. And on the flip side of things, it's really also not feasible and possible for the governments to do the entirety of the care provision. And so this is why it's really important to think through, how do we finance, how do we model long-term care services, long-term care systems. And so I think you've really hit a crucial point there in terms of space, where a lot more work needs to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I just wanted to bring us back to narratives. So how can narratives help improve the quality of life for people living dementia in marginalized communities? Are there any specific innovations that stand out to you that you could share with us?
Sure, there are very, very simple innovations. Sometimes when people hear the word innovation, they think it must be bells and whistles and a massive set of contraptions. But sometimes the simplest things can be innovative in specific types of contexts and settings. So, for example, using WhatsApp as a tool for shared information, to provide to one another practical support, to help really reduce the sense of isolation that carers can experience. That's a way in which telling your own story, claiming your own narrative, can actually be very powerful and is truly innovative. And so there are other fancier digital platforms apart from WhatsApp that we're seeing starting to come onto the scene in that really help with making that storytelling, that narrative shaping, much more polished in look and sound. So doing things like creating family books, family visual books, memory books, albums, those are some opportunities. And opportunities also, and innovations also, lie at this interface of not just the families using storytelling or narrative, but also when different players in this individual's ecosystem, personal ecosystem, are participating in that. So it's the family members, it could be the healthcare provider, it could be the meal on wheels deliverer. Each of them might have a different type of experience and interaction with this person who is living with this cognitive impairment and deterioration. And so these types of opportunities for storytelling are really powerful, particularly when they can facilitate things like this emotional support, when it can facilitate information sharing, when it can facilitate practical resource identification and resource exchange. And those are invaluable when the formal support is not very visible, is not well signposted, or it's just not accessible.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think to add on to that, I mean, like you said, there's various mediums, WhatsApp included, and I've seen in my research, because as you know, my PhD is on dementia narratives. So looking at how narratives kind of play a role in the lives of people with dementia and their carers. And so far, I've seen, blogging as a form of collecting narratives, applications, so apps design. Just for collecting stories, as well as videos, you know, so people have been instructed to do video diaries of their lives. So that can, I guess, tie into the life story book model of things that you also mentioned. So yeah, like you said, innovation doesn't mean groundbreaking, you know, millions of pounds design. It can be as simple as what is already existing, and we're just utilizing it, and it benefits the greater good. So yeah, I'm glad that you also mentioned that, because that's really important to us, I think, as well, to have low cost solutions, you know, that is accessible
Exactly.
to our communities. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. Because what good is it developing a solution that the communities that we say that we want to reach, they're not able to access? Either
Exactly.
because of the price point of that solution, because of the complexity of the architecture of that solution, and the inability of the actual services that are in the communities that we want to have these effects, the inability of the services to actually accommodate that complex architecture, technological architecture. So it's really important. We always, always, always must begin with that user experience in mind.
Agreed, agreed. And I wanted to find out, so how well does narratives integrate into the healthcare system? Like, what are the main barriers in terms of its usability for both patients and professionals? Because through my research, you know, during the PhD, I came across this terminology called narrative medicine. So it's a form of, I guess, I guess recording what is going on with that individual through a story. So the person comes, they talk about where they are now, where they were before, how they want to move forward. So it would be interesting to find out, you know, from your perspective, how that integrates into the healthcare system.
I wasn't familiar with that term before you introduced it to me just now, but it's an interesting concept, and it made me think immediately of the importance of collecting really detailed patient histories, client histories. And in a sense, when you do that, and oftentimes providers unfortunately don't have the time to do that, or it may take multiple sessions and a long-term relationship in order to do that. And it might not just be from the individual's perspective, but it might be from the other family members or other persons who are coming into that health or care interaction as well with the health provider. So you get a more 360 view of this individual in front of you. But often when you collect a detailed client or patient history, you are in a sense getting their story. You're getting their experience of their formative experiences, their interpretations of the key life events, their interpretations of the factors that have influenced their health and their outcomes. And this is where it's really important for providers, because you asked about the healthcare system and healthcare services. This is where it's really important for providers to be able to listen keenly. And sometimes that inability, that lack of culturally specific training, understanding what are some key words, what are our key signals, what are key ways of communicating that may not be verbal, they may be nonverbal in terms of if there's more than one person in the room and you see who's looking at who or who is the holder of information, who is seen as the communicator to the healthcare practitioner. Those are ways where I suspect that this approach that you've talked about in terms of narrative medicine, where that could be particularly useful, it could be particularly helpful in terms of understanding more clearly, as with any story, any narrative. A story is a story because it has a plot, and it's a story because it has characters, and it's a great story because it has a clear sense of evolution. And when you have the ability of a healthcare provider to be able to listen keenly, to discern that without layering their own assumptions about what a particular behavior might mean or a particular word might mean, and instead ask so that they can learn about the characters, the plot, and the evolution, that's when it could be particularly transformative.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it's a more natural way of interacting with the patient. So it doesn't feel like a disconnect between the clinic and the family, you know, because we're all trying to understand what's going on. You're sharing your story. I'm listening. And it is the natural way of life, right? When you have conversations. So I think it provides a bit more of a space, a safe space for people to share their stories. And in our culture, I mean, that's what we do. We share stories, for example, like Anansi, you know, it's what we do. So I think when we have that storytelling element in the clinic, it's quite powerful because people feel inclined to share more because that's how they've grown up to share stories. So it doesn't feel as clinical, in a sense for them because it's just like I'm sharing a story. And that's what I've known to do. So that's very interesting. And then I just wanted to bring it to a close in terms of final thoughts from you. So what are your hopes for the role of narratives, particularly online narratives, so what we've spoken about, you know, using the WhatsApp and so on in dementia care, in marginalized communities?
My hopes for that are that those interventions are recognized as the valuable spaces for information sharing and support that they are, that they're recognized for their irreplaceable power sometimes for training, because particularly given the transnational nature of so many of our families, and that some of our family members are doing caring from a distance, and that distance sometimes might mean that they're exposed to and have access to different resources, different information, and can share with those that are on the ground that information, that learning, that exposure that they've had. My hope is that we can really appreciate these spaces, these fora, as ones where we can truly incrementally provide dignified and person-centered care.
Amazing. Thank you so much. That's just been fantastic. And it's been wonderful, you know, exchanging dialogue with you. I don't know if you have any other further thoughts before we conclude the podcast.
I just want to encourage all of our listeners to continue to talk, whether you are from our communities or you see the issues in your communities and they may seem similar, or even if they seem different. I think it's really important for us to continue the conversations, to talk about these things, to learn about them, to recognize that dementia is not just about older persons, aging persons, but that it's important to have conversations about brain health, that your physical health is your brain health is your physical health, and for us to not silo these conversations. We are having, it's very soon next year, we're having the first Caribbean Brain Health Summit in Jamaica. And I really want that to be a space where there is dialogue around brain health as it's connected to our brain economies. We often talk about brain drain, but there's incredible opportunity with so many of these soft touch innovations, as well as the larger tech innovations. And just because we are such a connected and transnational type of community, there's so much opportunity for funders, innovators, researchers, clinicians, persons who are living with cognitive impairment, persons who are caring for others with cognitive impairment, to really be part of the ecosystem build-out. So that's my final call to action. It's please be an active part of this ecosystem build-out. If you, in any way, shape, or form, want to be part of that, but feel like you don't have a clue, reach out to us. Check out our website, imagibrainhealth.org. Reach out to us, info@imagibrainhealth.org, and we'll be very happy to continue these conversations.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And thank you to our listeners. And please do check out Isha's website and all the fantastic work that she's doing. And hopefully, we will see you in Jamaica.
Yes, we're
So,
looking forward to that, Rihanna. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here with you today and to be with the listeners. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
no worries. Thank you. Take care.
Take care.